Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 14th, 2005. This session is The Earth's Thermostat, Animal Predation and Invasive Species, Natural Systems in Control and Out of Control, presented by Brent Lofgren. In the Fireside Room today, 2005-02.
My name is Brent Lofgren. I'm seeing a few new faces relative to yesterday. I work at the Great Lakes Environmental Research Lab, which is part of National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. I'm located in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I was asked to recommend some books, and the one that is most relevant to today's talk is in the bookstore, and it's called The Web of Life by Fritjof Capra. And that is, not being a theologian, I have difficulty in connecting that to the concept of the web of life that was talked about by Larry Rasmussen last night. So I'm going to think of it in more of a scientific term. So I'll start with my PowerPoint presentation here. We're going to talk about the concept of cybernetics, which means self-regulating systems. And my Greek is pretty poor. I think I put the Greek word kubernetes there, which means steering. And that's what it's derived from. So one example of it is a home thermostat, which has negative feedback. So that's actually the thermostat in my office. I just snapped a picture of it and put in my presentation. And the way a thermostat works is when it gets out of bounds being too cold, it'll turn on the heat. Once it gets to a certain point and gets warm enough, it'll turn it back off. So it'll keep that temperature within a certain range. Usually they'll make that range so it's not unreasonably narrow, so that it keeps turning on and off very quickly. That is kind of wasteful and bothersome to have that happening all the time. Something sort of opposite of that would be a trampoline, where you jump on it and it springs you back up, and you force yourself back up even higher, and each time you jump on it, you're going to get higher and higher. Okay, some of the developers of cybernetics, the guy who pioneered the entire field is Norbert Wiener, and his theory had to do with sort of engineering type of things like the thermostat and regulators for engines and that sort of thing. Someone who examined these sort of things in more of a philosophical vein was Gregory Bateson, and he's written several books. And someone who looked more at natural systems and developed the principle of Gaia, which is the concept of the Earth as sort of a thinking system that through all of its physical and biological processes maintains itself in a certain equilibrium. And a little bit later on, I'll be giving a specific example that was invented by Lovelock. Okay, this is a super simple diagram of an ecosystem and a food chain. And it shows some aquatic plants at the bottom, and really where there's just a blank with an arrow on the left is plankton and algae. And those things are consumed by the little crab, and then the crab is consumed by sort of a smaller bird, and then this hawk type thing goes down and gets the other bird. So most of you have probably seen a diagram of a food chain like this, and a true ecologist would be ashamed to put this one up here because it's so simple. A real one has many more members at each of these levels and all sorts of arrows going back and forth. But this does represent a system that keeps control of itself and keeps each of those populations from going out of bounds. Different parts of this system consume each other. So when you have a disturbance in an ecosystem, one possible type you might have is sort of a bottom-up uniform effect. Primary producer means basically the plants that manufacture energy by photosynthesis out of carbon dioxide from the air plus sunlight plus a few nutrients. So they're really not consuming any of the other living things. So if the primary producers benefit under this bottom-up uniform effect, then all benefit. The next level up consumes that one. If it's plentiful, they benefit, and then the same thing passes on to each of the what we call trophic levels above that. If one of the species is suddenly affected by something like a disease, for example, you might get an alternating trophic level event. And I say that's usually transient. It might happen by something sudden, and then as time goes by, a new sort of equilibrium is reached among those different species. So in that case, predator's misfortune is prey's advantage. If the predator gets hit by a disease, the prey is going to proliferate for a while until they reach the limit of their food supply. All right, here are a couple of examples of cybernetics having to do with diseases. Two diseases there, very dread diseases, Ebola and AIDS. And they're actually transmitted by fairly similar means, by contact through bodily fluids. And people are really rightly frightened of each of these diseases, but they behave kind of differently. AIDS is really a dread disease that has spread across Africa, and of course there are a lot of cases in the United States. Ebola has more limited outbreaks and is very much feared by the people who are in those areas, but it doesn't spread as far. And the reason why Ebola is much less widespread than AIDS is that it kills people so quickly. It doesn't have a chance to spread. Whereas AIDS kills people more slowly and gives them time to propagate that disease. Okay, this is another cybernetic system, and this was invented by James Lovelock. And he called this Daisy World. And it is meant to mimic some of the behaviors of the real world, but not to include everything, so that it remains simple enough to get your hands around to really understand it. So he came up with this system of equations that govern the areas of black daisies and white daisies on this imaginary planet called Daisy World. Now, there are a bunch of arrows on that diagram on the left. It has incoming solar radiation, which has short wavelength. So that's the input of heat to this planet. Then there's reflected short wavelength radiation, and once you subtract those two, that's the net input of heat. Then emitted long wavelength radiation, and this is really the important part of the greenhouse effect. Long wavelength radiation is also called infrared radiation, and that is emitted by anything that's that has a temperature greater than absolute zero. And this is sometimes confusing for people, but basically it is light, but it's at invisible frequencies. If you see something that's red hot, that's quite hot, and that means it's just starting to emit in visible frequencies. If it's less than red hot, it's emitting at other frequencies that are not visible. So you've got a balance of incoming radiation and outgoing radiation, and part of the regulation of that incoming and reflected radiation is the amount of white and black daisies there. Black daisies absorb a lot of that radiation and reflect little. The white daisies reflect a lot of it. So if you have more white daisies, that's going to cool the planet. If you have more black daisies, that's going to warm the planet. Okay, on the right, this is going to get a little bit more complicated, but the demonstration of this is to change with time the amount of sunlight that's coming into this planet. And if you look at the top diagram on the right, the red line on there, that's starting with a small amount of incoming sunlight, and then it goes up to the right and follows that diagonal, and then all of a sudden it jumps up. And that jump up is where it's reached a warm enough temperature that all those black daisies start popping up. And that makes the planet absorb more sunlight. And then as you go further to the right, it stays right at that same temperature. It's keeping itself in control by, as there gets to be more and more sunlight, replacing some of those black daisies with white daisies. And then as you get all the way over to the left, just before it jumps up again, or all the way to the right, just before it jumps up again, it's going toward all white daisies and staying at that same temperature. Then it really reaches sort of a breaking point. It's no longer able to maintain that temperature that the white daisies like, and the white daisies all die. The temperature jumps way up at that point, and then the blue curve is sort of the same in reverse. It reduces the sunlight with time, but it actually has to get further over than that vertical red line in order to start having black daisies in this case. It starts out with white daisies as you're going from right to left, and then maintains a certain temperature. And the bottom graph shows the area of white versus black daisies. Go ahead.
Is this somewhat of an analogy around the issue of global climate change and snow cover of the earth?
There is an effect with snow that is very similar to this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so basically, I've heard Will Steger and other polar explorers who, you know, a lot of the large polar ice cap on the top of the earth is shrinking down, and so then it causes a very fast positive feedback loop of having ice melting more quickly, which means more sun being absorbed in the oceans. And example, one of the large ice shelves the size of Minnesota is now like completely gone, that he had traveled across about 15 years ago.
Actually, maybe I answered too quickly. What's being demonstrated here is actually a negative feedback, and what you're talking about is a positive feedback.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I'm going to be talking a little bit about positive feedbacks coming up. And the Steger thing you're talking about is primarily in the Antarctic. Is that
right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, similar things are happening in the Arctic. There's a difference between where it's land versus ocean as well.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, this is another thing that helps to maintain the temperature of the Earth, and I'm calling it the bucket brigade of atmospheric heat. The sun shines most brightly and brings the most heat to the equator, but then it starts transporting that heat toward the poles. And the balance between incoming radiation from the sun and outgoing thermal infrared radiation is positive input of heat at the equator and an output of heat at the poles. And getting back to what was just mentioned here, the amount of ice near the poles helps to determine how strong that contrast is between the equator and poles. And there are several different mechanisms that help to carry some of that heat between those, and they have various names. The Hadley cell nearer to the equator, the Farrell cell in the middle latitudes, and the polar cell at the high latitudes. And these all involve winds and various storm formation. And basically it's air mixing around and moving the warmer air toward the poles and the colder air toward the equator to help to balance it out. And really the effect of reduced ice cover near the poles is to reduce the need for having this transport of heat, the bucket brigade.
I'm wondering about, they have some theories about the whole Gulf Stream, which is another one of the mechanisms for getting heat from the tropics dissipated. And some Europeans are concerned about global warming.
That's coming up.
Oh, you're getting up to it.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Okay.
Wait, now, is that in this presentation or the next one? I don't remember.
A little teaser. I gotta come back to the next one.
I think it's in this one, yeah. Okay. The oceanic conveyor belt. And, there's a distinction between the oceanic conveyor belt and the Gulf Stream, and it's often lost in news stories. Okay, here's another mechanism for positive feedback in the atmosphere, and essentially I got a PhD thesis out of this, the Charney mechanism, and some of my colors aren't showing up so well, but this is one of the things that happens in the tropics. It's not so important at middle latitudes, but the part represented as the desert on the right is highly reflective. It doesn't absorb a whole lot of sunlight. So it tends to have a cooling effect on the atmosphere, and air sinks there. And the forest on the right, what you really can't see is the little lines there that I have to indicate rain falling on it out of those clouds. But the forest on the right absorbs more sunlight and puts more heat into the atmosphere. Now, when it puts heat into the atmosphere, part of that heat is in the sensible form. It heats up the atmosphere. Another part of that heat is latent heat. There's heat required in order to evaporate water. And so the actual temperature there might be cooler, but it's putting a lot of heat into the atmosphere in the form of water vapor. And then you get that rising motion due to that heat, and that forms clouds and rains on that area. So if you start out with a certain distribution of precipitation, you're going to end up with more forests in the area where it's precipitating and more desert where it's not precipitating, and that's going to magnify that contrast in precipitation between the two places. So this is a positive feedback loop, and every positive feedback loop needs some sort of backstop so it doesn't spin out of control. And in this case, the main backstop is that a forest can only get so dark, can only be so vegetated, desert can only get so bright.
Is that the mechanism right there effective in Africa, where they have some large-scale reforestation campaigns where they can try to change the microclimate by tree planting?
There's some of this effect on the microclimate. My PhD dissertation that I was mentioning really has this happening more on a larger scale, but it's less targeted when you try to do something on the micro scale. If you have rising air motion, it might fall in the wrong place other than where you intended it to. But what I've really studied is the contrast between the Congo, which is a large area, and the Sahara Desert. Mm-hmm. So those are big targets to hit with your rainfall. Okay, here's a Charney mechanism related quote from that relates to that previous slide. Every afternoon there was a rain squall that lasted for about an hour. The admiral writes that he attributed this to the great forests of the land. He knew from experience that formerly this also occurred on the Canary, Madeira, and Azores Islands, but since the removal of forests that once covered those islands, they do not have so much mist and rain as before. So these islands are losing their rainfall, apparently because of deforestation. That's the way it looks. And this happened a long time ago, and guess who this admiral is?
Cook?
Charney?
What's your answer?
Could you say Charney?
No, this is related to the mechanism invented by Charney, which was...
Not the admiral.
Charney actually wrote about this in the 1970s, but this quote happened much earlier than that.
Cabot?
Hmm?
Cabot?
Cabot, Cook, those are answers. Starts with a C.
Christopher Columbus.
It is Christopher Columbus.
Ah!
Wow.
Okay, then... these colors didn't come out quite so well either. Another thing I just sort of wanted to mention is negative feedback from evaporation. You've got the sun shining on this wet surface. It causes the air, initially it will cause evaporation. That will cause the air to moisten, and that will sort of form a backstop to that evaporation, especially if clouds form overhead. All right, cybernetic system's out of whack, or at least temporarily so. In the water dam, you'll start out in the former state with sort of a cybernetically controlled system where the water flow is controlled by the slope of the river. It sets up some sort of quasi-equilibrium. But then when you build a dam, that equilibrium is stopped, and reservoir fills. There's really no outflow during this stage. And then the end state, you establish a new controlled state where water is released under a human-controlled plan. But in either the former state or end state, you'll have a certain amount of water flowing in, and you've got to have the same amount of water flowing out. In the intermediate state, that condition is not fulfilled. Then locally, there's something sort of analogous to this. This is kind of I just added this, and this is kind of brought up by some questions that people have been asking me about glaciers and snowpack near Holden. And it's important to understand the difference between snowpack and glacier. A snowpack melts annually, or nearly so. It doesn't build up. If it doesn't melt this year, it had better melt within the next couple of years, otherwise it's going to turn into a glacier. In the case of a glacier, the snowfall exceeds the snow melt. It builds up with time, and it compacts into ice, then it flows down the mountainside, and it'll reach some altitude at which it will melt. Okay. This slide actually pertains only to glaciers. If you have a pre-global warming condition, there would be some sort of equilibrium in that glacier where the amount of melting at its lower end equals the amount of input elsewhere. So the mass of that glacier pretty much stays the same, and individual little pieces of ice will kind of slide down. They'll first fall as snow, solidify into ice, slide down over hundreds or thousands of years, and eventually melt at the bottom. But the same amount of mass is present there. Then you might imagine a future equilibrium with warming where there's no glacier. So either of these are essentially static states. But in between, the melt exceeds the input. Now, people were worried that global warming will mean that we're going to have no glacial water to supply water for Holden and for hydroelectric generation here. Unfortunately, that doesn't quite work, because in the transitional phase between the two equilibria, if we consider this to be the current state, we've got bonus water becoming available. We're taking it out of the glaciers for now, but then when that glacier is gone, that's not happening anymore. So if this is a significant source of water for Holden, which I'm not entirely convinced is true, it's an unsustainable source.
Do they have a way of trying to determine how much of their water is through rain and other things that get turned into groundwater and then flow downhill, or versus the melt from the annual snowfall under a glacier?
I haven't dug into that sufficiently to really be able to answer that.
It would be good for them to make plans for how to keep this village sustainable in the future, given the likelihood that accumulated snow will be more rain in higher altitudes and less snow.
Right, right. Now, yeah, I haven't looked into this closely enough, but my strong suspicion is that more of the water supply is actually from melt of annual snowpack, and the crisis of this summer is that there's not enough snowpack up there.
Well, see, the thing is, snowpack all through the Rockies and the Cascades is decreasing because of global warming.
Mm-hmm.
You have less snow in higher altitudes, more rain. So a lot of California's agriculture that's dependent on a runoff from the Sierras, from the snowpack, is going to become, water will become a crisis throughout the West because of the lack of snowpack.
Right.
And so there is a long-term issue for sustainability of Holden Village if they don't have a way of capturing all the rain and holding it around for the summer months.
Yeah, that's this slide.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Under global warming, and I inserted this all this business about glaciers and snowpacks in this area in this presentation, because I feel like I have more time today than I'm going to have tomorrow, but a lot of it relates to global warming, which is really my subject for tomorrow. But under global warming, there's kind of a lower level of certainty in most areas of the effect on total rainfall and runoff. And especially if you zero into a particular area, there's a fairly high level of uncertainty on what that effect will be. So last winter's low snow in this region, I said, is at least partly due to natural variability. I think it's very difficult to attribute it to global warming.
But even it wasn't even less snow, it was just less rain. There was a stretch where there was absolutely no precipitation for like a month, 2 months, where I live. I mean, that's just not fair though, where we went days upon days upon days with sunshine, which, you know, actually was quite nice because it's not normal, but right. But the rain that came, the rains that have come in May and now in June, where we've had, you know, days upon days upon days of rain.
Right.
So that's we've caught up on rain now, which is not great because now the grasses are growing, and when the sun finally comes back and it warms up, we'll now have it'll be a greater fire danger.
Right.
So.
Right. Now, I'm not sure whether you're trying to attribute that to global warming.
No, I'm not attributing it to anything. I would attribute it to natural variability.
Yeah.
At this point, I would say right now natural variability. If it happens again next year, but who knows?
Yeah. So, yeah, that's going to be one of my main points tomorrow, is that if it happens this year, it's tough to attribute. If it happens next year, then you've got a little bit more credence, and you really have to build it up over time.
Yeah.
If you look at other studies around the world of impacts of global climate change on distribution of rainfall and changes in ice pack and cloud formation, there are certain general trends that can be predicted for this area. And so you can take some of those general trends and try to start planning. Even though you can't exactly tell what the micro system will be, we do have fairly good science about general atmospheric trends related to global climate change.
Yeah. General worldwide trend is more precipitation. That's kind of what's expected generally worldwide, but that doesn't necessarily translate to more runoff. Or more snowpack, right. So my second point on this slide is that something that is more certain associated with warming will be less snowpack, perhaps transferred to rainfall. So the snowpack is where you naturally store water that will run off and can be used over the summer. So this is something that I think I feel better about saying we can expect to happen as compared to an overall change in the precipitation and runoff, just a shift in the seasonality of it. Okay, invasive species is a cybernetic system out of whack. They have the biggest system where they eat the same thing as a native species, but they have no predators. And it can negatively impact both the invasive's predators and organisms in the food supply. If these invasives are unchecked, they'll eat their entire food supply, so that's not good for whatever they're eating. New ecological balance may be achieved for better or worse.
Can you give an example of that?
An example of that is that in my region, there are the zebra mussels, mm-hmm. and those are well known. They were introduced from the Black Sea. And one of the things that they do that a lot of people might consider positive is they make the water clearer. They are filter feeders, and they suck in water that has little particles that are edible for them, and they spit out clean water. On the other hand, they're displacing some of the other mollusk species in the Great Lakes, killing them off, and some of the predators of those other things are adapting and eating the zebra mussels. Others are really disappearing as a result of the zebra mussels.
Are there many invasive species up in this valley here?
I'm not really sure. The one that I saw in the book over there is a plant. The foxglove is growing wild around here, and I'm not sure just what that is displacing.
This kind of, to me, I think of whenever you're going through customs and you're not allowed to bring fruit, right. seeds, all that. Is this kind of our human way to try to prevent an out-of-whack system? Introducing invasive or exotic species into...
Yeah, and in a lot of cases, in the case of the zebra mussel, it was really an unintentional introduction. But in the past, there have been a lot of intentional introductions of various species that have not gone as people intended.
Rabbits in Australia.
Yeah. Yeah, rabbits in Australia are...
Pigs in Hawaii.
Yeah.
And buckthorn in Minnesota.
Yeah, we've got some buckthorn in Michigan, and another one that's really big in Michigan is the purple loosestrife, which people used as a ornamental plant in their gardens, and now it just grows along all sorts of bodies of water.
English ivy out here.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
That's a big deal.
Okay, this is the Atlantic thermohaline circulation, also known as the conveyor belt. And this often gets into the news and is confused with the Gulf Stream. It has different causes and different characteristics from the Gulf Stream. And it's driven by the density of the water, whereas the Gulf Stream is driven by wind. So what happens in the Atlantic thermohaline circulation is that water from really all over the world kind of gradually funnels into the North Atlantic, just off the southern tip of Greenland, and that's the concentrated point at which most of the water sinks within anywhere in the oceans. And that's because as it approaches there, it gets cold and saline. Some of the water evaporates, and that leaves behind water with a higher salinity and a higher density. So more saline water, colder water, means that it's heavy, so it sinks to the bottom. And most other parts of the ocean besides that have just a very diffuse, gradual rising trend in the water. But it's suspected that global warming may stop that. The main reason for that is an expectation of increased rainfall in that region around Greenland. So you get more fresh water there, it doesn't get as saline, and it'll weaken that sinking motion or perhaps stop it altogether. And what this circulation does is it carries warmer water into that region at the surface. So that's the surface effect of it. So if you stop getting that warm water coming from the south, it may end up cooling off much of Europe, which initially seems sort of counterintuitive to the global warming theory. So given this change in this cybernetic system, you may establish a new set of temperatures throughout Europe. Okay, now this is sort of a sociological phenomenon. People want to pinpoint a cause for different phenomena that they observe. And there may not be a proximate cause for a lot of things. So this is really the phenomenon of chaos. Things occur by processes of such great complexity that they appear to be random. And I'm going to read you part of a children's story called Because a Little Bug Went Ka-Chew, which is by Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is a pseudonym for Theodore Seuss Geisel, one of his alternative pseudonyms. But this shows a chain of causality that may have happened, but sort of seems unlikely. I'll just sort of start it out and then skip to the end. You may not believe it, but here's how it happened. One fine summer morning, a little bug sneezed. Because of that sneeze, a little seed dropped. Because that seed dropped, a worm got hit. Because he got hit, that worm got mad. Because he got mad, he kicked a tree. Because of that kick, a coconut dropped. Because that nut dropped, a turtle got bopped. And then it goes on and on. Toward the end here, because of her phone call, more help came fast. They tied a strong rope to the Mary Lou's mast. And because of that rope, the boat didn't go down. But it had to be fixed, so they started for town. And because they went there, it's true, I'm afraid, they ran right into a circus parade. And that started something they'll never forget. And as far as I know, it's going on yet. And that's how it happened. Believe me, it's true. Because, just because, a small bug went ka-chew. So that demonstrates something that seems plausible but unlikely. And yet, you know, when you view the end result of it, it's tough to trace back the initial cause of it as a small bug going ka-chew. And one of the major examples of chaos theory is called the butterfly effect, where it's believed that it's possible for a butterfly to flap its wings in China and result in a hurricane in the North Atlantic. So that's possible, but you would never be able to trace that hurricane back to that butterfly. Just the limitation of data collecting would not take into account that butterfly. But certain environmental conditions may skew the probabilities within random distributions. So things that happen by apparently random processes, you can skew how likely they are to happen through changing the environmental conditions. Greenhouse warming is one example of this. You change the probabilities toward higher temperatures, but that doesn't mean that you're necessarily going to get higher temperatures every day than you've ever had. The other example is, El Nino is another example where hurricanes are less likely to occur in the North Atlantic under El Nino conditions. Okay, how do these two kind of play off of each other, cybernetics and chaos in combination? In an ecosystem type of setting, you might have a drought and it reduces the amount of forage available for deer and it reduces the population. That's an example of cybernetics. However, exactly which deer die, if you're outside of the system looking at it, it's difficult to predict exactly which ones are going to die. So that's more of a chaotic occurrence. Hurricane formation, as I said already, El Nino generally reduces Atlantic hurricanes, but hurricane formation remains a chaotic process. It still happens, and really could happen anywhere, but there's just a lower likelihood under El Nino conditions. And then people ask specifically about the 2004 hurricane season. It was unusual, really only in having so many of them hit Florida. The total number of hurricanes in the North Atlantic in 2004 was not all that unusual.
Isn't there somewhat of a trend toward higher numbers of hurricanes due to the increased amount of energy in the atmosphere?
There are differing schools of thought on that, and there's actually a news story from several months ago where one of the primary researchers on that area was on the panel who wrote that part of the report for the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change, and he had someone who was sort of his boss in that capacity. And the sort of lower down guy has an interesting name. His name is Christopher Landsea. And the other guy was named Kevin Trenberth. And Christopher Landsea actually quit that position because he was upset that Kevin Trenberth had said things that contradicted Christopher Landsea's research, where he was really the expert on that particular area. And he published that there was no strong evidence to suggest an increase in hurricane activity over time, and really very shaky predictions of that. And Kevin Trenberth went to a press conference and said exactly the opposite. And therefore, there is a fair amount of publicity that Chris Landsea sent out this open letter to the entire global warming research community saying why he had taken this action. So global warming is a well-accepted phenomenon among nearly all scientists, but some of the effects of it are more controversial.
Probably you just have to see what insurance companies are doing.
Insurance companies are responding to what the scientists have to say, and when we disagree, they get very confused. Okay. Global warming here. This is sort of an introduction to what I'm going to talk about tomorrow. The basic rules still apply, and it's still somewhat like Daisy World. The Earth still has a heat balance, heat transport like that bucket brigade, the water cycle, but some of the parameters are changed. Basically, the greenhouse gas concentrations are changed. Natural variability and chaos are always with us. You're still going to get one year being warmer than the previous one, and then the next one again being colder. And then I make the point that temperature and other records do not have tags that say this part is natural variability and this part is global warming. If you look at an observation, there's just not that distinction made in there. You have to put a whole lot of observations together in order to get a fairly good idea of what direction things are going on the long term. And corollary to that, most anything that has happened historically remains within the range of possibility, but the probabilities are shifted. So if you have warming, you're less likely to get what has previously been the cold extremes, more likely to get what has previously been the warm extremes. Okay, summary. Natural systems usually have some sort of negative feedback that keeps them within bounds. You might have some sort of positive feedback that will have some effect for a while, but it generally runs up against some sort of wall. If you get rabbits in Australia, they'll eat all the food they can, and once they've done that, then they probably won't increase their population much anymore. And then, that's the point in the second bullet there. And I said the churning mechanism can be limited by moisture availability, and I also gave the example where a forest can only get so forested, and a desert can only become so bare. So that's the end of my talk for today, and I'll be happy to entertain questions. Yeah?
I live in Spokane, Washington, and I had a coworker who remembers before the whole, area where the whole dam system was built up, the Cooley Dam and the whole irrigation system and the whole farming, that whole area by Moses Lake and even at the apple orchards and stuff, that's in the past several, it's like 50 years old. Some of this area is, what you see when you, that whole farming area is not very old. It was built up by irrigation in the past 50 years, and it was his belief that that's changed our climate on our end, because what was once desert, not farmable,
right,
now has irrigation, and because of the green farmland, that changed what we have as far as...
Isolated irrigation areas are something they call the oasis effect. If it's surrounded by dryness, you're going to have that area, which is going to have a lot of evaporation. It's probably a different color, which means that a different amount of sunlight is going to be absorbed there. And that can have large effects on the local climate.
We're talking lots of acres. Acreage now.
Yeah, and that is all sorts of land use transformations are happening all over the world at the same time as greenhouse gases are increasing. So really both of those are important. And again, there's the thing about observations not being labeled for, I said this one, this piece is natural variability, this piece is global warming, this piece is local climate change due to putting in irrigated land.
Yeah. That would be an optimist and hope that the Gaia theory is true and that no matter what we do to this world, this planet, that somehow it's going to be able to correct itself regardless. But I just wonder, how do you factor in or study human intervention, whether it's intentionally positive or it's meaning to be helpful and ends up being harmful? I mean, how do you factor all that in when you're studying these effects? How can you really truly, just like the butterfly effect, how can you truly make the observations to know how much of what we're doing is really causing impact or not?
One of the points I'm going to make tomorrow is that we run computer models which are based on theory, and that's one means of looking at it. And when you put those together with observations, it builds up a stronger case for what you think might be happening. And of course, any of those models is not perfect, and they're expensive to run.
Do you think we're on target? I know this is your work, but just do you feel like there is enough to make good, reasonable assessment?
I think we have a lot more work to do.
Mm-hmm. That kind of raises the question, could we be wrong? You know, if it's a theory.
Yeah, well, the overall concept of global warming, I would say, is very certain. But there are a lot of subsets of that that still require a lot of guesswork, and I'm going to show the schematic diagram of cascading uncertainty. So if you've got some sort of predictions about what's going to be the general trend on a global scale, then you break that down into a very local scale. Then you say, well, what's going to happen to the grass in this area? What's going to happen to the fish? Those get to be more specialized questions and add on another layer of uncertainty.
I was wondering, is there going to be a talk later in the week about the impact on like more third world communities?
Yeah, that's Thursday.
Okay, Thursday.
Yeah.
Just because of the effect of evaporation, with higher surface temperatures, evaporation will be greater in areas that have droughts and deserts. Whatever water supply they try to have, it seems like evaporation is going to really be hardcore on the third world.
Yeah. Commercial message for Thursday is one of the particular places where I and some people from Michigan State University are looking at the effects of irrigation is on the slopes of Mount Kilimanjaro. That the Maasai people there traditionally are herders, and they're fairly well adapted to arid lands, but the government is subsidizing irrigation there, so they're switching to farming, and in some ways giving up their culture to do that.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
This is a pretty basic question, but when you look historically at how climate has changed and whether or not you attribute it to or what you attribute it to, how are we that much different right now compared to even back biblically when they had 7 years of drought and 7 years of plenty? And you can't base assumptions on changes over 1 or 2 years even then.
No, you can't.
So I'm just wondering, how much different are we really than history has shown?
Yeah, well, we're just as time goes on, we're through the observational record, we're building up more and more confidence by just adding on that much more data, and it comes from different sources. One of them, the most obvious, is surface temperature observations. Another one is recession of glaciers. Another one is times of bird migration in various places. So you put these all together, and there are some problems with how to put those together, because it's sort of comparing apples and oranges and trying to come up with a single answer. Yeah, Paul.
Does cybernetics speak to the enormous kind of geological changes? I'm thinking ice ages and Lake Agassiz. You talked about that last night. Would you believe that that's within a cybernetic kind of pattern, that places where there was enormous water at one time, there will be again, and where it's some out of those?
A lot of the cause of the ice ages is a positive feedback. Basically, it starts with a change in the orbital characteristics of the Earth. So the amount of sunlight that is reaching the Earth actually at different seasons, because the northern hemisphere has much more land than the southern hemisphere, so there's a difference in temperature depending upon whether we're closest to the sun during the northern hemisphere summer or the southern hemisphere summer. So those orbital characteristics will start it out, then you might start getting a little bit of encroaching glaciers into northern Canada, say, and then that'll start cooling off the entire planet, and you'll keep getting those glaciers moving further and further south.
Back to the topic of human interference in our ecosystems, if there was to be like a wide, like global scale kind of assault, like what happened in Yellowstone, for example, humans believing that wolves were a big source of threat to their economic society, and they took that out and in exchange for their own security wiped out entire populations of different types of saplings because of overpopulation of elk until the wolves were reintroduced to the park. Is that more possible, especially now because more things are happening in advance of human technology?
It's still very possible. I hope that we have a little more knowledge than we did back then. And when I get to talking about the third world, a lot of the issues there have to do not with getting rich, but surviving. So people are pushing the land to its limit just to survive and trying to preserve small pockets of nature in order to bring in tourists, and there are sort of different problems in those areas. I hope that in the United States we've learned a lot of lessons that will help to prevent that in the future. So that's our time limit.
Okay.
But I'm happy to talk with anyone individually. And I'm going to have office hour in the sauna after.
It should be hot by now.
Thank you.
Great, thank you.
Yeah.
Great.